most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai. And this is a program where we go through the Bhagavad Gita verse by verse with as much detail as we possibly can, and taking records in Swami's words, Swami's writings. We've completed 6 chapters. The last week we had a summary of the 6th chapter and we did not complete it completely. We did the first 32 shlokas. We have 15 more shlokas to go, and I promise to complete that before we move ahead to the 7th chapter. So we'll do that. We'll start by completing the 6th chapter. It's the portion that we're going to do. This last 15 shlokas are very important because they are centered around a couple of very important critical questions that Arjuna poses to Krishna. And in some ways, these are questions that can be answered only by Lord Krishna, as we'll see. But before that, the first question that Krishna asks in the 15th shloka, in the 33rd shloka, in the 6th chapter, is a question that I think bothers a lot of us. I'm sure each one of us can relate to this in our own way. We listen to a lot of spiritual advice. We're in the middle of a program where we listen to a lot of spiritual advice. And as I've made it very clear before, it is not me advising you. It is we just talking about the advice that Swami has given us, be it through the Bhagavad Gita or through the Gita Vahini or his many discourses. So I just relay the advice to you, and hopefully as I'm relaying it to you, a part of it also sinks into me. So in that sense, we listen to a lot of spiritual discourse, advice, we read a lot of spiritual material. But however much we try, that never seems to become a constant experience, isn't it? We all know bhajans has to be sung with a lot of feelings and bhavam. We just concluded the bhajan tutor program, and I'm sure every week Bishu and the other participants emphasize that, how important bhavam is, and we've heard it many times from Swami, but it's an experience that we all have, and if we are honest with ourselves, it is not that every time we sit for bhajans, it's not that every time we sing bhajans, we are able to do it with that same feeling. Same is the case with when we sit down for any kind of prayers, be it our morning meditation or our prayers after our bath, before our work, or the prayers that we chant before we eat food or go to sleep. It's not always that we are having that kind of a complete involvement when we are doing any of these spiritual activities or sadhana. Especially what Krishna has been speaking about in the 6th chapter, where he said you're supposed to see the Lord in everyone that you interact with. That's something that we all struggle to do. I can talk about myself when we are trying to see Swami in the people we interact with. Yes, there are times when you're able to consciously do that and it gives you a very good feeling from within when you're interacting with a person and you're able to truly get yourself to see Swami in that person. But it doesn't happen all the time. It doesn't happen every day. Once or twice it happens and then we are back to being hurt and hurting others, liking and disliking, wanting and not wanting, and we again get back into that cycle. And this is the very question that Arjuna raises, and that's why it's so very important, because Arjuna is asking this question on your behalf, on my behalf. He says that this yoga that has been spoken by you as sameness, as being equal or equal, having an equal vision towards everybody in every situation. Arjuna says, O Krishna, I do not see its steady continuance. Stitim Sthiram. He says, I understand what you're saying, but I don't see it in me as being, I don't see me being able to hold on to that experience steadily. And why is that? He says, owing to the restlessness, chanchalatvat, the restlessness of the mind. And then comes the famous shloka where Arjuna describes the mind very appropriately. He says, chanchalam hi manak Krishna, pramathi balavadridam. Tasyaham nigraham manye vayuriva sadushkaram. O Krishna, the mind is indeed unsteady, destructive, strong and obstinate. To control it, I believe it is as difficult as to control the wind itself. Swami further elaborates this in the Gita Vahini by saying, Arjuna says, "O Krishna, all this sounds fantastic and very pleasant to the ear. Those who are successful must be very blissful when they are able to achieve this. But what you say is extremely challenging even for the spiritually evolved, but close to impossible for simple people like me." Now, if Arjuna, the great archer who is known for his phenomenal focus and concentration, is saying that, God help you and me, right? What can you say, what can we say about us? The next two shlokas are very important because Krishna gives one of the most important tips about mind control for a spiritual sadhaka. It is in fact so simple that we run the risk of not giving it its due importance. The first thing that Krishna says is, "Asamshayam mahabaho mano durnigraham chalam." Undoubtedly, O Arjuna, it is indeed very difficult to control this fickle mind. And in that simple statement that Krishna is making, where he is agreeing to whatever Arjuna has said, I think is the first hint to all of us. Because we must first acknowledge that it is not an easy task. Spirituality is, as we discussed, one of the greatest adventures, and when we acknowledge it, we will be more prepared to take on the challenge and put in the necessary sadhana. As Lord Yama tells Nachiketa, "Kaschit dhira," a very few adventurous ones turn the mind inward in the quest to view the self. So this path is not for everyone, it is for those who are dhiras, who are adventurous enough and also are committed enough. In the next line of the same shloka, Krishna says, "Abhyasena tu Kaunteya vairagyena cha grihyate." Through abhyasa and vairagya, O Arjuna, it can be controlled. But Krishna says it can be controlled, but you need two tools, which are abhyasa and vairagya, through practice and detachment. From Swami's discourses, we understood what these two words truly stand for. Swami had said, abhyasa is nothing but tapas or penance. And he went on to say that there are three types of penance. Sharirika, relating to the body. Vachika, relating to the speech. And manasika, relating to the mind. Of course, these do not mean difficult austerities that we often associate with the word tapas. They are all different forms of disciplined life or different aspects of leading a disciplined life that Swami would otherwise expect us to follow. And whenever Swami speaks about our discipline and following a decent life, this is what Swami always says. So the idea is to practice leading a disciplined life, a regulated life, which otherwise the mind doesn't like. The mind is not fond of. The mind is always looking for or seeking to be let free. So to cultivate good thoughts, to refrain from speaking such words that hurt, that are false, these calls for abhyasa or practice. So Krishna says that the mind can be controlled, but it has to be like any other wild animal, any other wild beast. It calls for practice and long effort to supplicate it, right? So that is the first thing that Krishna says. And then he says vairagya. The quality of vairagya is constantly reminding the mind of the fleeting nature of all things that we interact with in the objective world. Be it wealth, pleasure, relationships, authority, and all such things. But Swami says, when describing this aspect of vairagya, he says, mere contemplating on the nature of the world will not lead us to that vairagya. Even if it does, that vairagya also will be momentary, just like everything in the world. So Swami says that we must also contemplate on the absolute nature of God. So as one develops vishaya virakti, that is dispassion towards the objects of the world, simultaneously one also develops daiva anurakti, attachment to God. So these two go hand in hand. So vairagya is not only contemplating constantly on everything being ephemeral, but even as you do that, you have to also remind yourself about the absolute. So Vishaya Virakti coupled with Daiva Anurakti is what Swami says is Vairagya. Krishna then summarizes his answer by saying, this yoga is difficult, but it is difficult for those who don't have control over the mind. But it is very much possible for those who strive and control the mind. The last part of the sixth chapter, that is from shlokas 37 to 47, is on a slightly different note, or I should more precisely say 37 to 46. 47 is slightly different, and we will see why. Arjuna raises a question at this point, and Krishna, in the course of answering it, as I said, some of these answers cannot be given by everybody and anybody. Krishna has said it is possible, but it is difficult, right? When he spoke about the path of yoga or the path of trying to have the samadrishti. When you say a path is difficult, it means two things. One, that it calls for a lot of effort. And the other is the percentage of success is quite low. So Arjuna asks this question, what happens to those who fail? What happens to those who are not able to make it on this path? Those that have taken to the path, they have faith that this is the right path to walk on. They also strive. But then, because they do not have it in them, because they have not controlled their mind enough, they stray away from this path. What happens to them? Aprapya yoga samsiddhim kam gatim krishna gacchati. What happens to these people who are unable to find their success in this path? In the next shloka, in fact, Arjuna thinks, in this shloka that we just discussed, he asks the question, what happens to them? In the next shloka, he kind of reveals that what he thinks happens to them, because he thinks that such people end up being total losers. Because he says that they are a loser with regards to the spiritual journey, but they also end up being losers with regards to the world, because they've given up that and they've come to this and they've lost here too. So doesn't such a person get completely destroyed? And having expressed this doubt, Arjuna says, O Krishna, only you can clear this doubt of mine, because no one else can tell me with authority what happens to one who is not able to reach the path in one lifetime. What happens to that person after that lifetime ends? What happens in the next lifetime? Everybody else can only probably hypothesize, but only you can tell me with authority. Krishna puts all these doubts to rest by saying, Kalyana krita kaschit nahi durgatim gacchati. Verily, no person who is a doer of auspicious actions ever gets ruined. So very clearly Krishna says you don't have to worry about such a person being ruined at all. A yogi, by nature, he or she tries to spiritualize all actions that they perform. These include even the mundane actions. So in that sense, when you're trying to spiritualize every action, from what duties you perform to what profession that you do, all actions become auspicious. Because what do we call as auspicious actions? Prayer is auspicious. When we do a yajna ritual, that is auspicious. Now when a yogi tries to spiritualize every action, what happens is he becomes a kalyana krita. All actions that he performs are auspicious. And when all actions performed are being made auspicious, there is no way that such a person can be ruined. In the next few shlokas, Krishna explains what happens to such a person who is referred to by Krishna himself as a yoga bhrashta, one who has failed in the path of yoga. In the 41st verse, Krishna says, firstly, the person reaches punyakritam lokaha, the land meant for those who perform such good deeds or punyas. What we can say is, he is very loosely referred to as heaven, right? And then he says, such a person resides there for countless years. Shashwati hi samaha. And the idea is, when we talk about heaven, we are talking about a state where there is no concept of time, right? So the idea is that such a person lives in heaven. for a period of time that cannot be quantified in our earthly terms. And that's why he says, Sashvati hi samaha, what appears like countless years. Then he is Shuchinam Shrimatam Gehe Abhijayate. He or she is born in a house that is prosperous and cultured. If this doesn't happen, Krishna says, the person is born in a family of yogis, Yoginam Kule. But then he adds that is a little more difficult birth to attain than being born in a Shuchinam Shrimatam Gehe. The idea that Krishna very clearly and beautifully conveys is the yoga bhrashta is given a condition or an environment where that person doesn't have to struggle for basic necessities in life and can go forward and pick up from where he or she has left it and move ahead in the spiritual path. But this also can be a problem because we know there is always a danger with wealth, with money, with comfort, with luxuries. Will it make a person more worldly? Will it make the person lose one's path? Or being born in a family of yogis, will it make one complacent? So Krishna clearly clears even that fear in the next few shlokas of this chapter. He says, in the next birth, he reacquires that paurva dehikam buddhi samyogam, that buddhi that he had acquired in the previous body, paurva dehikam. He reacquires that understanding and that intelligence, that spiritual intelligence that he had gained. Not only that, he will strive further and reach much ahead than he had earlier reached. Yatatecha tato bhuyaha samsiddho. He says whatever he has reached, he reaches more than that in this birth that he is blessed with. Krishna is not only stating that the yoga bhrashta will have benefits in the afterlife in the form of being in the punyakritam lokan, but he says in the next birth in terms of conditions into which the person will be born, but he is also stating that the yogi or the yoga bhrashta will start off from where he or she had left off in the previous life and move further, move closer to the goal. And this happens literally following Newton's law, right? An object in motion will continue to be in motion. Similarly, a yogi, Krishna says, will be pulled into the spiritual path even in spite of that person. Tena purva abhyasena eva, verily by this previous practice, avashaha api hriyate saha. He is helplessly carried forward or dragged forward because of these past practices, past spiritual practices. And eventually, Krishna says, the goal is reached. But then Krishna reminds that this goal is reached over many, many lifetimes. This has to be always kept in mind. This is an adventurous path. This is not an easy journey. So it is a journey that spans many lifetimes. Aneka janma samsiddha. And this is a param gatim, the final point in the journey. As we have seen, gati means the path. Param gati means the furthest you can go in this path. That is why this is also beyond what a good life promises, what the Veda promises. After this point, there is no further distance to go. So this is, in any path, the furthest path is the destination. Right? So in Krishna says, param gatim, it means over many lifetimes, aneka janma, you eventually reach the final point in this destination. Krishna concludes the chapter with an exhortation to Arjuna and of course to all of us. He says, O Arjuna, be a yogi. He says, Jnanibhyah api mataha adhikaha. I'm sorry, before that he says, Tapasvibhyah adhikaha yogi. Superior to the ascetics is the yogi. Jnanibhyah api mataha adhikaha. The yogi is considered higher than even a jnani. Karmibhyascha adhiko yogi. Greater than the men of action is a yogi. And then he concludes with that exhortation, Tasmat yogi bhava Arjuna. Therefore, O Arjuna, be a yogi. Krishna describes the yogi as one who has samadrishti, who is able to see the same self in all. Krishna says this yogi is greater than a tapasvi, a scholar or a man of action. It is a command that one must seek this goal, right? When Krishna says tasmat yogi bhava arjuna, he says seek this goal. This must be the aspiration and nothing less than this must be aspired for. So even though it is impossible to probably wake up one day and say that today onwards I'm going to be a yogi, because yesterday I read in the Gita that Krishna is saying, telling to Arjuna that you should become a yogi. You cannot do that. You cannot wake up one day and become a yogi, but you can certainly wake up one day and resolve to have this as the goal and nothing less than that. That resolution that we can always do, right? So that is what Krishna says when he says, tasmat yogi bhava arjuna. Have this as your goal, have this as your striving. The final point that Krishna makes, he says, even among all yogis, this is the last shloka, which I said is slightly different from the theme that has been spoken. Of course, it is not completely off the meaning also, but we will see in what way this is a little different from the rest. So the final point Krishna makes is, even among all the yogis, he who adores me with his mind fixed on me and with faith, he is considered by me to be the best of the yogis. He says, there are many, many different kinds of yogis, but that yogi who has faith in me, whose mind is fixed on me, I consider this as the best among yogis. So what does this mean? One way of seeing it is, Krishna is again praising karma yoga, right? That is a context which is never never to be lost sight of. Because as we've discussed in the past, there can be no karma yoga without devotion to God. So only when you have bhakti can you do all your actions as an offering and draw satisfaction merely through your actions being performed as worship. Another way of looking at it is, which is again an extension of the point that I just made, in the case of a devotee, sometimes even the aspiration for moksha becomes secondary. The devotee wants nothing but to think of and please the Lord. So in a way, it is more selfless than even the aspirations of a mumukshu who is keen on liberation or who has his eyes set on liberation. So if one is capable of being a bhakta who desires nothing but to love God, he or she becomes a more exalted devotee than every other type. This again is something that we have spoken about before, because any action, any karma that is performed becomes perfect when Swami says that you do not look beyond the karma, you don't look at the fruits of that actions and perform it perfectly. Similarly, when you talk about any sadhana, Swami says it becomes perfect when you do it for the moment and do not look at anything that is beyond that moment as being the reward for that sadhana. When we say that, then the nature of a bhakta becomes a perfect description of a yogi like that, because the bhakta does not even look at, a true devotee does not even contemplate on the idea of moksha or being liberated or being a master of one's destiny. He only draws joy from that moment of loving the Lord and serving the Lord in whatever he or she does, right? So probably in that sense, Krishna is saying that being a yogi of this sort is greater than all the other yogis, right? So this concludes the sixth chapter. And this is where the one third of the Bhagavad Gita ends. Let us now begin the seventh chapter. And as I said, the summary last week and even before we started the sixth chapter, there are multiple names for the sixth chapter. Dhyana Yoga, Atma Samyama Yoga, and there was another name. So there are two, three names, and depending on how commentators and scholars would like to see it, they choose to call it by that name. But for the seventh chapter, there is one very clear name, and that is because Krishna himself clearly states that this is the theme I'm going to speak on for this chapter. course, he doesn't say seven chapter, but he says that now I'm going to speak on this theme. And from what Krishna says, the chapter is called Jnana Vijnana Yoga. In the second verse of the chapter, Krishna makes this statement, and we'll be coming to that. I think we'll have enough time to come to that. Before we come to what Jnana Vijnana means, which we will probably do when we go through that verse, as I said, and also as we proceed through the chapter, we will be coming back to that discussion every now and then. But before that, from this point, there is an interesting change in the subject of the discourse as well, and this is observed by many, many scholars of the Gita. Of course, as I've been reiterating over and over again, the basic discourse is the same. The basic theme is Karma Yoga, and Krishna's instructions, as Swami says, the essence of it is Mama Dharma, to follow one's Dharma and to perform one's duty. But all this explanation comes from what Arjuna told Krishna right in the beginning of the second chapter, where Arjuna said, Krishna, I am confused, so you tell me what to do. So when Arjuna tells Krishna that you tell me what to do, it means that he's saying, I will do what you tell me to do. But then he says, but also accept me as your Sishya, as your disciple, and explain to me why you want me to do what you want me to do. So what Krishna had to say was already known even before Arjuna's submission in this manner, because Krishna has already told Arjuna, get up and fight. So he knows that when he tells Krishna, tell me what to do, Krishna is going to tell him, get up and fight. But then he says, accept me as your disciple and explain to me why I have to fight. Right? So Krishna is saying, you have to fight because that's your duty. Why you must do your duty, and when you're doing your duty, how you must do your duty, and all this explanation is what becomes this entire Bhagavad Gita, right? And in the process, a very important explanation that Krishna gives is, how is doing one's duty, how does that fit into this larger picture of one's purpose of one's life, into this larger picture of reaching the ultimate goal of human life, right? So this entire thing is based on that. That is why the Karma Yoga is a discourse which we should never lose sight on. Talking of Arjuna's submission, that he will do what Krishna tells him to do, I think this is something that we have to keep in mind, that Arjuna has already pledged his obedience, and that is why Krishna is giving this entire discourse to him. And talking of that, I'm reminded of a very beautiful episode that happened to my senior, one of my good friends who is 1 year senior to me in college. This happened when he joined Swami's school in the year 1996 for his 11th standard. For those of you who are aware, who follow our discourse stream, the year 1996, Swami gave a series of discourses. Swami would give discourses every day, and it went on for quite a considerable amount of time. Suddenly one day Swami stopped the series of discourses. Swami, of course, got it announced that the students' exams are coming, and so he doesn't want to disturb them. But the scene inside, or the scene with the students, were completely different, because Swami seemed completely upset and quote-unquote demoralized. Because Swami started saying that, what's the point in me giving discourses? Nobody listens to me, and the boys are the same. They don't transform their habits. They are talking too much, and they are wasting their time here. So this is something that we've heard very often from Swami, and I mean, it's absolutely true that we certainly, as students, in our impetuousness, did not give Swami all the attention and focus that Swami and Swami's words deserve. So every now and then Swami would bring that to our notice, that this is something that we are missing out on. So that was one of those occasions, 1996. Swami stopped talking. Inside, Swami was very upset. Swami was not talking to his students. And Swami made it very clear, even to the warden. Swami said, this is why I'm not speaking, because it's no point in giving you advice that you are not ready to follow. So this was going on for some time. And whenever this happens, there would be a mass self-introspection that happens in all the hostels. the students would start becoming more disciplined, or different kinds of sadhana will start in the hostel. And one of the things that most of the students would do is start writing letters to Swami and trying to inform Swami that they're very sorry about displeasing Swami, and they will do their best to follow whatever Swami tells them to. So this senior of mine whom I was talking about, he had just got into Swami's school, and he was very, very hurt that, you know, that we're doing this to Swami. And so he wrote a huge letter to Swami. He says he took 4 foolscape papers and he wrote, he filled it with his thoughts and his prayers, and asking Swami to forgive them and ask Swami to resume his discourses. And he also felt that, you know, here is Swami giving a series of discourses. So many devotees are benefiting from it. And because we students are not living up to Swami's expectations, so many of these devotees also have to miss out on what Swami has to give. So he writes this huge letter, puts it in an envelope, and he sits in Mandir hoping to hand it over to Swami. And even as Swami is coming, I think Swami is coming out of the bhajan hall and going into the interview room. I think that must be the scene. When he's trying to catch Swami's attention with this letter, and Swami sees that this boy is holding a letter, Swami comes straight to him. Swami takes his letter. And Swami goes inside the interview room, and barely 10-20 seconds, Swami's out. Certainly in 20 seconds, you can't read even half of the page that he's written. He's written 4 full pages. Instantly, Swami comes out within 20 seconds and comes straight to him. And Swami asks, "Where is Arjuna?" And this boy is a little perplexed. This is why Swami asking him this question. And he thought that there was another student at that point in time in the hostel whose name was Arjun. So he thought Swami is asking for him. And he said, "Swami, I think he was sitting somewhere here. Should I look for him?" Swami said, no. "Where is the Arjuna who is mentioned in the letter?" And this boy was even more surprised, because there's no way Swami would have read that. He wrote so many things, and one of the things that he mentioned, as I'll explain in a short while, was about Arjuna and Krishna. And Swami was coming out and asking, "Where is the Arjuna who is mentioned in the letter?" And he explains that what he had written in that letter is among the many things that he poured out. He said, "Swami, this is not right. You know, you gave the Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna, and you gave the Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna because he was not doing the right thing. If he was anyway doing the right thing, you wouldn't be giving him your discourse. The very fact that Arjuna was not doing the right thing, you stopped him and you gave him the discourse. So if we are not doing the right things, then it is all the more reason for you to give us the discourse and not stop. How can you say that we are not following you, so you have to stop the discourse?" And Swami just responded to that one portion that he had written, and he could see that Swami was very pleased with what he had written. So Swami called him, and Swami patted him heartily on his back, and then Swami said, "Repeat after me." And he didn't know what Swami was going to say. Swami said, "Repeat after me." And Swami said, "Karishye." He said, "Karishye." "Vachanam." And he said, "Vachanam." And Swami said, "Tava." And he said, "Tava." And Swami repeated this 3 times and made him repeat after him in front of everybody. Everyone was seated around there. And Swami said, "Good boy," and patted him, and then left. And this was the episode that happened, and it was a very pleasant thing, that pleasant memory that he carried from his school days. But many years later, he had the opportunity to ask Swami the significance of this episode. He said, "Swami, this is what I had written in a letter, and this is what you said. What is the lesson from that I need to take?" And what Swami said was very important. And even as we are going through the Bhagavad Gita, I think it's very important for us to keep this in mind. And that's why I thought I should narrate this even as we are going through the verses. Swami said that it is true that Arjuna was faltering and Krishna gave him the discourse. But Krishna gave Arjuna the discourse only after he expressed this mental attitude of obedience. Only after Arjuna clearly stated, as I just said in the second chapter, that "I am ready to do what you tell me to do." After he explicitly stated that position of his, only then Krishna gave him the Bhagavad Gita. Of course, we know the very statement "Karishye Vachanam Tava" does not come till the fag end of the Bhagavad Gita. In fact, that is the last dialogue that Krishna, Arjuna speaks to Krishna. He says, Krishye vachanam tava, I've heard enough. All my delusion has been removed. I will do exactly what you say. Though the statement itself comes in the 18th chapter, as I said, even before Krishna begins the discourse, Arjuna says, O Krishna, I will do what you tell me to do, but please explain to me why I should do what you want me to do. Right? So Swami very clearly was telling that boy and through that boy to all of us, Arjuna deserved the Gita because he promised to obey. So there is no point in us going through this Bhagavad Gita if we have not committed ourselves to the message, right? So that should be our commitment to Krishna. So the entire Gita is Krishna explaining to Arjuna why he must be a Karma Yogi. And when Krishna concluded the last chapter, he said very clearly, Tasmat Yogi Bhava Arjuna, therefore Arjuna, be a yogi. And that also is a reference to Karma Yoga. Right, he doesn't say Tasmat Karma Yogi Bhava Arjuna, but it is understood that that's what Krishna is saying. But as requested by Arjuna, Krishna is now explaining Karma Yoga completely. Some scholars explain that the Gita can be more or less split into three distinct parts. The first six chapters form one part, the second six chapters form the second, and the third, and of course there are disagreements. Some people say, no, this is not how it should be split. But more or less, you can see that there is a certain sense to this observation. The first six chapters, Krishna spoke about the nature of the individual, the Jivatma. In the Vedantic Mahavakya, that is often quoted as the essence of the philosophy of Vedanta, Tat Tvam Asi. In that, Tat refers to the Brahman, the divine being. Tvam represents the individual, right? So the meaning of the word Tat Tvam Asi is that thou art. You are divine yourself. In that, Tat means the divine, Tvam means you or the individual, and Asi, which means that you are that. The first six chapters in the Bhagavad Gita, they say, represents or is references to the Tvam aspect, or the individual Jivatma is described, his role is described, what he must do is described. So the first six chapters refer to the Tvam aspect, and from the seventh, Krishna speaks about the Tat aspect. And as we go through the different chapters after the seventh, the eighth, the ninth, and so on, you'll find that more and more there are descriptions about the Supreme Being. So Krishna, starting in this chapter, is going to speak about his own true nature, the nature of absolute divinity. Of course, technically speaking, Krishna summarized the, Krishna is going to go back and forth it's not that he's not going to talk about the Jivatma at all. If we just look at the sixth chapter, which we just completed the summary of, the sixth chapter is in fact summarized in the penultimate shloka where Krishna said, Tasmat Yogi Bhava Arjuna, right? He says everything, he describes the yogi and all the descriptions are done. And then he says, so Arjuna, you be a yogi. But after that, we saw one more shloka where Krishna says, the one who is focused on me is a greater yogi among all yogis. That is more or less a connecting shloka to the theme that is going to be discussed in the seventh chapter. And we saw this even in the end of the fifth chapter, where Krishna gave a few hints about meditation towards the end of the fifth chapter, and thereon he took it from the sixth chapter and he spoke more about dhyana and the dhyana yoga portion. So when Krishna says, Mat gatena antaratmana shraddhavan bhajate yoma, who is merged in me with the mind, one who is with faith, worshipping me at all times as a greater yogi. It means that this path of worshipping him, worshipping God one-pointedly, is a superior path, or in some way, this path makes things a little more easy. And why is that so? Even though Arjuna doesn't ask this question, you know, Krishna makes a statement that this yogi is better or this path is better, Arjuna doesn't ask why. But that is a doubt that is likely to come. In what way are you saying, Krishna, that this is a better path? If you tell me that this route or this path is better to reach the destination that you want, I should ask you on what basis are you telling me this, so that I can judge for myself, right? But of course, when it comes to Krishna's discourse, it's not that I want to judge, but definitely the question raises that in what way is this better? So Krishna goes on to answer that unasked question. Why is this better, or why is being a yogi who is concentrated and focused on the Lord better? And in the course of that, Krishna is going to discourse on the nature of Tat, or nature of Krishna himself. So with that introduction, we'll go into the chapter, we'll go into the seventh chapter. We listen to the first verse. As always, it has been rendered by Brother Shyam. In spite of the lockdown, in spite of all the constraints, he's been kind enough to do it for us. So we'll listen to the first verse of the seventh chapter in his voice. I'll give you a brief meaning of that. And with that, we'll commence the seventh chapter of the Bhagavad Gita.
Shri Bhagavan Uvacha Mayasakta Manah Partha Yogam Yunjan Madashrayah Asamshayam Samagrammam Yathanyasyasi Tachrunu.
The Blessed Lord said, O Partha, hear how you, having the mind fixed on me, practicing the yoga of meditation and taking refuge in me, will know me with certainty and in fullness. So that's the first verse of the seventh chapter, and straight away Krishna addresses that unasked question that we spoke about. The first line of that shloka is the connecting line, where he repeats what he had said in the previous shloka. But there are some interesting words and that he uses. We'll come to that. There are some very important meanings and understandings that we can draw from that. But before we come to that, Krishna says, by doing this, asamshayam, without doubt, samagram mam nyasyasi, you will know me in my entirety. Yatha. How? Tat shrunu. That you hear now. Right? So that is the tone that Krishna is setting. So you want to know how? I'm going to speak about that now in this chapter. So in the last shloka he had said, the one who is focused on me with faith is the highest among yogis. Why is that so? Because such a person knows Krishna or the Supreme Brahman in entirety. How? That Krishna is going to explain how knowing Brahman is connected to becoming a yogi of the nature that he described in the previous chapter. In other words, Krishna is going to explain one of the most profound Vedic declarations, Brahmavid Brahmaiva Bhavati. The one who truly knows Brahman becomes Brahman. So there are two things that Krishna is going to explain. That is, Brahmavid. Understanding Brahman, first of all. And how knowing Brahman, Brahmaiva Bhavati, how is that connected to you becoming a perfect yogi or you becoming one with Brahman? Specifically, Krishna says, Samagram Mam Nasyasi, knowing me in fullness, in entirety. Arjuna knows Krishna. Arjuna knows Krishna as a friend. He knows him as a relative. Probably he even knows him as a divine being. Maybe he even acknowledges Krishna to be an avatar. He might have that realization too. And in a very similar way, we also know Swami, right? We know Swami, we know him as a person, we know Swami as an avatar, we know Swami as a divine personage. But we don't know Swami in his entirety. Because knowing him that way means we will be in the state of a yogi that Krishna described. Mam pashyati sarvatra sarvam chamayi pashyati. you will see me in everyone and you will see everything contained in me, right? Because if I see Swami as who he really is, I will recognize him within me. I will recognize him in every person I meet, right? So we do not have that samagram, samagram, the word that Krishna uses there, in entirety. We know Krishna, we know Swami, but we don't know him in entirety, right? And that is what Krishna is going to be explaining in this chapter that we're going to cover. Let us now go back to that first line. Krishna says, Mai asakta manaha, with mind focused on me, madashrayaha, taking refuge in me, yogam yunjanna, practicing yoga. And thereafter he says, who does this knows me in entirety. And Krishna has made it more than clear already that knowing Krishna as the Supreme Lord is no different from knowing one's own self. Adi Shankara explains these two terms, Mai Asakta Manaha and Madashrayaha, very beautifully in the commentary that he gives for this verse, and it gives a perspective into the path of devotion or bhakti itself. The word ashraya means refuge, right? I think in many Indian languages also the word is used. Ashraya means refuge. But when we use it in the context of someone who is in the quest for something, the word ashraya is that which is the means. I want happiness, and if I pursue wealth to attain happiness, then wealth is my ashraya. I want to reach heaven, so I start doing rituals and yajnas. Then rituals become my ashraya to reach my goal of heaven. So when Krishna says madashraya, it means that aspirant who takes refuge in God, who takes or who turns to God as a means for the ultimate. A bhakta, a jnana yogi or a karma yogi all have the same goal. Jnana is the goal for each one of these people. Samadrishti, or the ability to see oneness in everything that one comes across, is the goal, whether you are following the path of jnana, karma or bhakti. But in the case of a bhakta, one for whom the path or the means itself becomes God. A devotee is one for whom the ends and the means is God. And Adi Shankara very beautifully says, when your means and ends is God, then what else is there for you to think about? That is why Krishna says, madashrayaha mai asakta manaha. The person's mind is hence constantly fixed only on me. He is ever focused on me. And as Krishna said in the previous chapter's last shloka, madgatena antaratmana, being focused on me with all the faculties of the mind. When you have a destination, which is divinity, which is God, and then you take refuge in God, he becomes the path, he becomes the destination, he becomes the means, he also becomes the companion. And when you have the means, the ends, the companionship and everything of God, then where else will the mind be? Asakta manaha. The mind will be completely focused and completely tied to the Lord. And as I said, probably the devotee doesn't even think of the ultimate goal. He doesn't even have to think of the destination. The mind is so absorbed in the Lord, and it is so absorbed in the Lord in the present. And there is no mind space even for the desire for moksha. And through this path of depending on God as the means, as the ashraya, one knows God in his entirety. It's a very important statement. As I said, this chapter to the next six chapters, which means ending in the 12th chapter. And the 12th chapter is a very important chapter. It's the chapter on Bhakti Yoga. For those of you who don't know, and if I have not mentioned this before on the show, when Swami wanted the primary school students to learn few verses from the Bhagavad Gita, Swami asked them to learn verses from the 12th chapter. The second chapter where Krishna speaks about the where Arjuna asks about the Jnani, right? Those few verses where he speaks about the Stitha Prajna, and the 12th chapter where Krishna speaks about the devotee and the relationship between the devotee and the Lord. Swami would say that he wanted them to learn these two chapters verses. So that's how much importance Swami has given. So this, what Krishna is saying at this point, in the beginning of this section where he's going to speak about the nature of the Lord and the nature of this relationship with the Lord, he is going to repeat it even in the 12th chapter, that you can know me in my entirety when you have this quality of mai asakta manaha, when your mind is completely absorbed in me, madashrayaha, when you take complete refuge in me, right? And Krishna says, mam yatha nyasyasi tachruna, how I am known, or how to know me, that you listen to now. So this is the theme of not just this chapter, but the following few chapters, which as I said, will culminate in the 12th chapter, which is going to be about bhakti completely. But this is a demarcation as for our understanding, so to say, because already we've seen, even in the second chapter, Krishna spoke about his the nature of Brahman. In the third chapter, when Krishna was speaking about karma, he spoke about how he performs karma. In the fourth chapter, Krishna spoke about the nature of the avatar. So it is not that it has never been spoken about in the previous chapters. It is not that Krishna is not going to speak about the Tvam aspect at all in the next few chapters. In the 12th chapter, in fact, Krishna is going to speak about the devotee. He is going to say that such a devotee is dear to me. So this is a demarcation for our own understanding. It is not so clear, so categorical in that sense. But the bottom line is, Krishna is speaking about karma yoga, how best to perform the duties that you are supposed to perform. So that's the first chapter. I think we'll have just about time to also listen to the second verse in the chapter. And we'll discuss it briefly before we conclude this week's episode.
Jnanam teham savijnanam idam vakshyamyaseshatah yajnyatva neha bhuyonyat jnatavyam avasishyate.
I shall declare to thee in full this knowledge combined with realization, after knowing which nothing more here remains to be known. So this is the second verse of the seventh chapter. This is a shloka where Krishna says what he intends to speak about in the following chapters. And this is where the name for this chapter also comes, which is Jnana Vijnana Yoga. As Krishna himself says in this, Jnanam sa Vijnanam idam. This jnana with vijnana aham vakshyami, I will declare, or I will make it clear, te to you asheshatah, in fullness. So because Krishna says, now I will explain to you jnana and vijnana, it is clear that this is the topic for this chapter. So there is no ambiguity about that. We discussed about this combination jnana vijnana even in the previous chapter, because at one point Krishna describes the yogi as a jnana vijnana triptatma, one who draws self-satisfaction from jnana and vijnana. When jnana is mentioned alone as a word, it invariably means supreme knowledge. It has come many, many times, even in the second chapter and the previous other chapters. But when it is said jnana vijnana, jnana and vijnana are used together, then jnana becomes somewhat a lesser form of knowledge, or not the supreme knowledge. Because as they say, the prefix V, when you add V to jnana, V stands for vishesha or special. So jnana vijnana means, probably you can define it as knowledge and wisdom. Now, Swami says in Jnana Vahini, I'll just read out two lines where very clearly Swami explains what is vijnana and what is jnana. Swami says, and I quote, vijnana is the name given to the actual experience of Brahman. It is a special type of jnana. Unlike the common fund of information got from the study of books, the net result of the study of any branch of learning, the fruit of all that study, is also sometimes referred to as vijnana. End of quote. So very beautifully Swami explains, jnana is the knowledge that you receive from elders, from sages and from the scriptures. But vijnana is that which is the actual experience of that knowledge, the fruit of the study of these many books, as Swami puts it. So that is what we had discussed during the previous chapter too. When we say jnana vijnana, it refers to knowledge that is paroksha and aparoksha. When jnana becomes one's own experience, it becomes vijnana. Because paroksha means seeing through the other's eyes. When you read from a book, when you listen to the words of great sages, they have had the experience, I have faith in them, so I depend on their vision. That is what it means by paroksha. Aparoksha means it has become my own vision. I have had the vision of the Brahman myself, right? So now when I read in the Gita that Swami is in every person, I accept that as truth and try to live by it. So this knowledge is paroksha. It is not my experience, but I accept it out of my faith. But at some point, hopefully not too late, not too distant into the future, this will become my own experience. It will become aparoksha, meaning not seen through someone else's eyes, but through my own experience. So Krishna says he is going to explain jnana and vijnana. What does this mean when Krishna says I'm going to explain jnana and vijnana? One possible way of looking at it is, Krishna is going to give knowledge that is vijnana for him. Of course, he is knowledge himself. Right? So there is no question of this knowledge that he is going to speak about being paroksha. Krishna is wisdom. I think in one of the chapters that we covered, Krishna says this, I am wisdom, I am knowledge itself. But when Krishna says, I am going to tell you jnana and vijnana, it could be a way of calling our attention to the fact that what Krishna is going to teach can be partially found in the scriptures as jnana, but some of it is probably not going to be found elsewhere. Because he is going to give vijnana, which is as I see it, as others have not seen it. Probably that is one of the ways by which we can look at this statement where Krishna says, I'm going to give you jnana and vijnana. Another way of looking at it is, Krishna is going to explain jnana in a manner that it is going to become vijnana for Arjuna. He is going to teach it in such a manner that this paroksha jnana is going to become aparoksha to Arjuna. It is going to become experiential in the way Krishna is explaining it. And this is the ultimate, as Krishna says. He is making it very clear here. There is nothing more to be known beyond it. He reiterates that in the very next line. He says, yat jnatva, having known which, iha, here, na bhuyaha anyat, there is nothing more else, jnatavyam. What ought to be known, avishishyate, remains. So having known this, then nothing remains more to be known other than this. As we've discussed multiple times before, this is one of the very beautiful ways of defining that supreme knowledge. That which, after knowing which, there is nothing more to be known. Right? That's how the supreme knowledge, the supreme jnana is often defined. And this description occurs in multiple Upanishads. One of the classic ones is in the Mundaka Upanishad. It starts with this very question where the spiritual aspirant Shaunaka, who is supposed to be a grihastha actually, most of the Upanishads are discussions between a student and a guru or a monk and a senior sage. But this is one of those very few conversations where a grihastha comes to a sage and asks this question. Shaunaka, who is supposed to be a very great very dharmic person who turns to spirituality, comes to sage Angirasa and asks, Kasmin Bhagavo Vignate Sarvamidam Vignatam Bhavati Iti. Oh, adorable sir, which is that, having been known, all that there is, that is to be known, becomes known, right? So this is a constant refrain in many of the Upanishads. And interestingly, Shaunaka uses the term vijnata in this, isn't it? So, suggesting that we are talking about not only knowing, but we are talking about experiential knowledge. And very similarly, when Uddalaka asks his son Shvetaketu this very question, when Shvetaketu returns from, I think, 12 years of learning in the Gurukula, and he's filled with pride that he has mastered so many knowledge, I mean, so many skills, and he's become a scholar of different kinds of learnings. Uddalaka, the wise one, asks his son this very question: have you learnt that, my son, by knowing which you have learnt everything? Right? So in summary, Krishna is saying, I'm going to teach you jnana and vijnana. You better pay attention, because what I'm saying is very special. Right? So that's the sum and substance of this shloka. He's calling our attention to what he's going to explain in this portion of the Gita. Well, he doesn't need to say that, because every portion of the Gita, as we've seen, is very profound, and it's very, very important to each one of us. So with that thought, dear listeners, I conclude this week's episode. I most humbly offer this at Bhagavan's lotus feet, and I thank each one of you for joining me week after week. I thank each one of you for the feedback that I constantly receive from all of you. Please continue to send me your thoughts, your feelings. If you want to correct me in whatever I've said, whatever I've explained, feel free to do that. You can write to me personally, or you can write to our feedback email, or even send your feedback to our WhatsApp number. I'll meet you again next week, 7:30 PM. We'll resume this Triune Pilgrimage of the Gita series. We'll continue with the 7th chapter. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the last segment of today's Thursday Live, the Vahini Satsang. Till I meet you all next week, take care, keep safe. Jai Sai Ram.